It's Monday, June 17, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Over the weekend, the most significant political development was the election of a man described as a moderate cleric, that is, Hassan Rouhani, as the new president of Iran. Now, what's going on here? The Iranian Republic is not exactly a textbook example of an electoral democracy, but there was an election held. And not only was it held, there were six candidates who were running. And the man many considered one of the lesser, if not least, expected to win, actually won, and on the first ballot. That tells us that there is at least some dimension of democracy in the Republic of Iran. But it also requires us to look further. In the first place, what does it mean in Iran for a candidate to be described as a moderate cleric? Well, the contrast to this is with the outgoing president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was unable to run for a third term. Ahmadinejad has become infamous during the tenure of his reign in office for having called for such things as the end and destruction of Israel and, of course, pushing for a nuclear power, a nuclear weapons capacity within Iran that has threatened to destabilize not only the region, but the entire world. But what we need to recognize is that not all democracies are alike. For instance, in the United States, a democratic process honed over decades, indeed over two centuries of constitutional rule, has developed to the point that we can recognize how someone runs for office, and they're qualified at first for the ability to get enough signatures on a petition and then to get enough votes to stay in the race. But in Iran, the only candidates qualified and able to run were six men handpicked by the supreme leader, a religious leader there in Iran, that is, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And the supreme leader had the ability to not only certify these six men to run, but to keep others, such as former Iranian President Rafsanjani, from being able to get a place on the ballot. So this is not a democracy American style. This is not even a democracy European style in terms of a parliamentary system. This is a very different understanding of democracy. But sometimes when you look at an election like this, it might tell us that there is some change afoot. After all, this was the man no one expected to win. But in Iran, a man characterized as being a moderate doesn't actually have to be very moderate at all. We'll wait to see what it means this time for a moderate cleric to have been elected the president of Iran. Well, here's an interesting question. How well do you know your neighbors? People in Minneapolis, Minnesota must be asking themselves that question after the revelation over the weekend that one of their own neighbors, 94-year-old Michael Karkos, was actually a Nazi war criminal. As David Rising of the Associated Press reports, the revelation that a former commander of a Nazi SS-led military unit has lived in Minneapolis for six decades came as a shock to those who know 94-year-old Michael Karkos. World War II survivors harshly condemned the news, and prosecutors in Poland have said they'll investigate. An Associated Press investigation, according to David Rising, has found that Karkos served as a top commander in the Ukrainian Self-Defense Legion during World War II. The notorious unit is accused of wartime atrocities, including the burning of villages filled with both women and children. One of his neighbors said, quote, "I know him personally. We talk, laugh. He takes care of his yard and walks with his wife. For me, this is a shock," he said, "to come to this country and take advantage of its freedoms all of these years. It blows my mind," end quote. It's likely blowing many minds as well. Karkos told American authorities in the year 1949 that he performed absolutely no military service during the Second World War. He concealed his work as an officer and as a founding member of the Legion and later as an officer in the SS Galician Division, and that according to records that were freely obtained by the Associated Press through a request made by the Freedom of Information Act. Now, the Associated Press report indicates that Karkos is not directly linked to the atrocities in terms of having a firsthand witness say they saw him fire a weapon or explode a bomb or set a building on fire. But the laws covering war crimes do not require that there be such evidence, especially for someone who was the officer of a unit that is directly implicated in these kinds of war crimes. Again, David Rising reports tell us that the Ukrainian company he commanded massacred civilians. And the records also indicate that Karkos was at the scene of several other atrocities. Nazi SS files say explicitly that he and his unit were also involved in the notorious 1944 Warsaw Uprising. That is one of the darkest moments in World War II. At that moment, Jewish leaders in the ghetto there in Warsaw had done their very best to revolt against the Nazi oppressors who were not only, of course, oppressing them, but murdering them. And the absolute put-down of that uprising is one of the darkest moments in all of Polish history, as well as the history of World War II. What in the world are these neighbors in Minneapolis thinking? they saw this man as one half of an elderly couple, a couple who had lived in Minneapolis for the better part of six decades. Those neighbors in Minneapolis must be thinking hard about just how well they know not only this particular couple, but each other. In reality, there are secrets in every household, usually not something so dark as the secrets hidden in the Carcos household in suburban Minneapolis. But what we see here is something that should be on our minds continually. We can't read human hearts. We can't look behind the eyes of an individual as much as we might like to think we can and understand exactly what is going on in that mind and in that heart. We cannot see what God alone can see. We see a neighbor, and especially an elderly neighbor, watering his lawn, taking care of his plants, and living peacefully with his wife. We assume that this is a picture of the way things should be. Furthermore, in the United States, we see a couple like this come from Eastern Europe and come in the aftermath of World War II and live peaceably among us for decades. We assume they must have been victims rather than perpetrators of whatever crimes might have taken place during World War II. But that is not always the case, as the city of Minneapolis awoke this weekend to discover. Several years ago, the novelist Stephen King, known for his horror stories, wrote a story about just this kind of incident. The story, entitled The Apt Pupil, was about a young teenage boy who eventually connected the dots, figuring out that the elderly man who lived in his neighborhood was actually a Nazi war criminal. This is, of course, not fiction but fact now in Minneapolis, and it appears to be so well attested by the records not only in the United States but also the very records of Nazi Germany that this 94-year-old man is likely to find himself, if he survives, before a human rights tribunal and a war crimes court. And that's the way it should be, because even as our eyes tell us he's a harmless old man, the records tell us something otherwise. In terms of worldview importance, there are several issues that have arisen over the weekend. One of them appears in a story that was in Sunday's edition of the New York Times. James Gorman reports on a story, the headline of which is Goal of Broader Protection for Chimpanzees Emerges from Changing Perspectives. I promise you, this one is loaded with worldview implications. As Gorman writes, more than 50 years ago, Jane Goodall, then a young researcher at what would become the Gombe National Park in Tanzania, began introducing the public to the, quote, fantastic beings, end quote, she had studied and lived with. In her book, In the Shadow of Man, and in later works, she showed the world complex animals with intricate social lives and helped change the way the world looks at the great apes. On Tuesday of last week, Dr. Goodall, now 79 years of age, a longtime champion of chimpanzee conservation, participated in what may turn out to be another milestone. She joined the director of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, Daniel M. Ash, in announcing a proposal to add chimpanzees in captivity to the endangered species list. This is a very interesting story. Gorman continues reporting, wild chimpanzees have been listed as endangered since the year 1990, but the new proposal, which is open to public comment for 60 days, covers all chimps, including approximately 2,000 captive chimps in the United States. The listing, if adopted, would block most experimentation on them, stop interstate trade in the animals, and perhaps discourage the use of chimpanzees in entertainment. The worldview implications of this proposed new rule were made clear by Jane Goodall herself in this article in the New York Times. She said, quote, what the chimpanzee has done is to prove there's no hard and fast line dividing us from the rest of the animal kingdom. That's the greatest gift the chimpanzee has given those of us who care about animal welfare, end quote. A very interesting statement. The us in this statement means human beings. She said again, what the chimpanzee has done is to prove there is no hard and fast line dividing us from the rest of the animal kingdom. That's the greatest gift the chimpanzee has given those of us who care about animal welfare, end quote. In other words, Jane Goodall here straightforwardly argues that there is no hard and fast line between human beings and other animals, and in particular, other primates. She points to the chimpanzee as having given us this lesson, this greatest lesson, she says, the lesson that there is no real distinction between human beings and other primates. It's a very interesting argument, and it's backed up by the director of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, who said, quote, the chimpanzee is said to share 98% of our genes. It's in our nature to protect and conserve this iconic species, and this proposal will help, end quote. Now, recall that most important quote in this story from Jane Goodall. She argues very straightforwardly that there is no, quote, hard and fast line separating human beings from the rest of the animal kingdom, and primates in particular. But can she even hold that argument herself? Just a few paragraphs later in the article, she makes the argument that the main commonality between human beings and chimps is genetic or genomic. Going back to Mr. Ash's statement, the 98% of our genes are in common. She then says, very interestingly, I would not talk about chimpanzees having personalities. That was the worst anthropomorphic sin, end quote. Now, that's a very revealing statement. If there is no hard and fast line separating human beings from chimpanzees, then what in the world is this distinction, a distinction in which she wants to clarify, saying chimpanzees shouldn't be spoken of as having personality when human beings do? As if to underline the incongruity, indeed the contradiction in her argument, she comes back and says, speaking of the confusion of chimpanzees having personalities like human beings, she said, quote, that was the worst anthropomorphic sin, end quote. Well, if it's an anthropomorphic sin to confuse chimpanzees as having personalities like human beings, then what kind of sin is it to confuse the fact that there is a hard and fast line separating chimpanzees from human beings? This is another indication of the fact that if you want to press an argument, you're going to have to press it in one direction. You can't have it both ways. In reality, this is one of those articles that demonstrates the incredible confusion of the secular worldview. A secular worldview, a naturalistic worldview that seems absolutely determined to say there's no distinction between human beings and other animals, and then turns around to say, oh, but it's an anthropomorphic sin to confuse human beings with other animals. You can't have it both ways. That's why the biblical worldview holds to this distinction in a very clear and consistent way. We're not caught in the same conundrum of trying to make an argument in both directions. Changing to the issue of religion in public life and religious expression within the United States Constitution, today marks the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision known as Abingdon School District versus Shemp. The decision was handed down June 17, 1963, and it's a part of the sequence of decisions on church and state, and in particular on the public schools, that began in the late 1950s. These decisions together led to the radical secularization of the public schools in the United States, and this one decision, Abingdon School District versus Shemp, stands at the very center of that great transformation. 50 years ago, the Supreme Court handed down the decision, and we're dealing with the after effects even now. The case began when Edward Shemp, a Unitarian Universalist who was a resident of the Abingdon Township in Pennsylvania, filed a lawsuit suggesting that the law in Pennsylvania, which was then one of four states, requiring the reading of Bible verses before school classes in the public schools, violated his constitutional rights. His case eventually reached all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where it was joined with a case that had been filed by none other than America's most notorious atheist of the 20th century, Madeline Murray O'Hare. Shemp was arguing that his constitutional rights were violated when his daughter had to be involved in a Bible reading. Madeline Murray O'Hare made the same argument about her son in two different states. But the court combined these two cases into a massively important decision that radically accelerated the secularization of the public schools. The Supreme Court eventually decided 8-1 in favor of Shemp and declared sanctioned organized Bible reading in the public schools to be a violation of the United States Constitution. Just a year earlier, the Supreme Court had handed down the decision in the case Engle v. Vitale. In that case, the court ruled that prayer within the public schools also amounted to a violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. Now, just a year later, 50 years ago, the Supreme Court handed down a decision that said after school prayer was unconstitutional, Bible reading in the public schools was likewise unconstitutional. Justice Thomas Clark wrote the majority opinion in the case, but a concurring opinion was written by Justice William Brennan, later known as one of the most liberal members ever of the United States Supreme Court. In his concurring opinion, Justice Brennan said, quote, whatever Jefferson or Madison would have thought of Bible reading or the recital of the Lord's Prayer in public schools, our use of history must limit itself to broad purposes, not specific practices, end quote. That is a very revealing statement. The defenders of the practice of public Bible reading in the public schools had made very clear that these very practices had been conducted by the founders of the United States of America, in particular the framers and the ratifiers of the very United States Constitution that the plaintiffs in this case argued had been violated. The reasoning here is quite simple. How can something be unconstitutional if the framers and ratifiers of the Constitution involved themselves in the very same practice without seeing any contradiction whatsoever? Justice Brennan turns history on its head. He says that it really doesn't matter what the founders did, it only matters what they wrote. Again, his statement was this, whatever Madison or Jefferson would have thought of Bible reading or the recital of the Lord's Prayer in public schools, our use of history, meaning the court's use of the history, must limit itself to broad purposes, not specific practices, end quote. In other words, you can make whatever argument you want from history if you're going to describe history only in terms of so-called broad purposes. It's the actual specifics of historical occurrence that frame the debate in the way it must be accountable. In this case, the Supreme Court said we're not accountable to the actual facts of history, only to how we construe its broad purposes. It was an 8-1 decision. The dissenting justice in this case was Justice Potter Stewart. He said, and I quote, "It is, I think, a fallacious oversimplification to regard the religion clauses as establishing a single constitutional standard of separation of church and state, which can be applied in every case to delineate the required boundaries between government and religion. As a matter of history, the First Amendment was adopted solely as a limitation upon the newly created national government. The events leading to its adoption strongly suggest that the Establishment Clause was primarily an attempt to ensure that Congress not only would be powerless to establish a national church, but would also be unable to interfere with existing church establishments. So matters stood until the adoption of the 14th Amendment, or more accurately, until this court's decision in Cantwell." End quote. Justice Stewart's dissenting opinion also included this very important paragraph, which has reverberated throughout history thereafter. He wrote, quote, "If religious exercises are held to be an impermissible activity in schools, religion is placed in an artificial and state-created disadvantage, and a refusal to permit religious exercises thus is seen not as the realization of state neutrality, but rather as the establishment of a religion of secularism, or at least as governmental support of the beliefs of those who think their religious exercises should be conducted only in private." End quote. That does reverberate because it was prophetic. 50 years ago today, Justice Potter Stewart's dissent was handed down in this decision, in which he said that the government was now running the danger through the United States Supreme Court of establishing a religion of secularism, or, as he wrote at the very least, giving government support to the beliefs of those who think that religious exercises should be conducted, but only in private. If nothing else, on this Monday, we should all be reminded by this anniversary that history matters. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, just go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.